My own view is that Justin Amash has reached a different conclusion than I have. I respect him. I think it's a courageous statement. But I believe that to make a case for obstruction of justice, you just don't have the elements that are evidenced in this document. And I also believe that an impeachment call is not only something that relates to the law, but also considers practicality and politics. And the American people just aren't there. And I think those that are considering impeachment have to look also at the jury, which would be the Senate. The Senate is certainly not there either.
That was Senator Mitt Romney of Utah talking Sunday with CNN's Jake Tapper about the first Republican member of Congress to call for President Donald Trump's impeachment, Justin Amash of Grand Rapids, Michigan. Amash is the only elected official on Capitol Hill to prefer the self-descriptor libertarian over the name of even his own political party. And on Saturday, he dropped a turd in the punch bowl of GOP politics by laying out on Twitter his reactions 1 month later to the Trump-Russia report by special counsel Robert Mueller. The money quote therein is, Mueller's report identifies multiple examples of conduct satisfying all the elements of obstruction of justice, and undoubtedly any person who was not the president of the United States would be indicted based on such evidence. And also, Mueller's report reveals that President Trump engaged in specific actions and a pattern of behavior that meet the threshold for impeachment. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Editor's Roundtable edition of The Reason Podcast. I'm Matt Welch, joined by Peter Suderman, Nick Gillespie, and Catherine Mangu Ward. Happy warm weather day, friends.
Yay, warm weather.
Boo, warm weather, but
thanks,
happy Monday.
How hot is it there in D.C. where Peter Suderman lives?
Exactly the right temperature.
It's hot as Drogon's fire.
We disagree.
Oh, boy. What was the carbon footprint of that dragon, by the way?
I am the throne, and I am being melted as we record this podcast.
I think that's kind of good.
Spoiler alert.
By the way.
If anybody who is going to complain on Monday morning after the series finale of Game of Thrones about spoiler alerts can go F themselves.
How many more Game of Thrones podcasts are you going to record over there in the D.C. office, Catherine?
This
13, 14 more?
This one is the last one, but I have to say I have a whole prepared metaphor about how Justin Amash is Jon Snow, so we can do it now or
Let's
we can do it later, but
go
it's going to happen.
Get into it.
Okay.
Get it out of the way.
So again, full spoilers here. So turn this off if you haven't seen the episode. Jon Snow in our last episode has to choose between loyalty and what he knows to be right. After a fair amount of waffling, he decides to both express verbally his loyalty to the throne, to Daenerys, while also literally stabbing her. That is basically what Justin Amash did this weekend to Donald Trump. He was like, I love America and the presidency, and just stabbed him, right? However, this does not necessarily go great for him politically. And in the end, he spends a while getting like kind of gross looking in prison and then gets sent back to the wall where he rides out as part of the Night's Watch with the Wildlings, which if anybody in American politics are the Wildlings, it's clearly the Libertarian Party. And that is his fate. Into the wilderness, but principled and possibly will save the realm. Eh?
Yeah, he's going to look great. Amash will look great with a man bun.
He would look good with a man bun, y'all. That's just the truth.
And like an IKEA rug slung over his shoulder?
Yes. Justin Amash in fur. Yeah. I'm here for it.
Let me awake myself from a slumber of incomprehension and try to get action.
In dreams begin responsibility, Matt.
Thank you.
In dreams begin responsibility.
Every second of the day is a moment I'm awake or something.
Yeah.
Peter, I want to get into the actual argument that Amash made. He made it out in his typically sort of smooth social media thing. As we all know, certainly he tries to explain every single vote that he has, either on Facebook and or Twitter. And I was nodding my head along mostly with what he was saying until I got to the phrase, undoubtedly any person who is not the president of the United States would be indicted based on such evidence. What is your general conclusion or impression of Amash's conclusions, Peter?
So I want to tweak just a little bit something you said when you introduced this, which was that Amash called for impeachment. Unless I'm misreading this, he did not. What he said was that Trump had engaged in impeachable acts. And that is a little bit different, right? It is
split
that it is
them hairs.
And it's, and and so while this is, it is like a definitely splitting hairs here. It is
you're
in some ways
splitting hairs in the man bun.
It is in some ways, you're right.
I'm
splitting Justin Amash's man bun hairs.
Do it
for no, but
you're
this is important.
Right, though. There is
which
an
is,
important distinction.
Like if you read the report, the Mueller report, which is what Amash his whole thread was. I actually read the entire thing. That's why it took me a month. Right, that like I carefully considered this, you know, which again is good and more than most pundits and members of Congress did, and so we should I think respect him just for that. What he is saying is that the acts described in the report meet the threshold for impeachment, which is different than saying that President Trump should be impeached. And if you look at the what was described in the report, I don't think there's any question that that Congress could decide to impeach Trump based on what was described there. They impeached Bill Clinton for far less. And if this, if the kind of the, and another part of this, you know, that Amash gets at is that if the partisan roles were reversed, if this were Hillary Clinton in the White House, and there were a report that were half as damning as what Mueller put out about Trump, I don't think there's any question that there it would be absolutely unanimous amongst Republicans that they would be impeaching. They would be in the process of impeaching Hillary Clinton. And so
absolutely unanimous. Absolutely unanimous.
All right.
Even after
very,
you know,
very close.
20 years later, after
it'd be overwhelming. All right. Let's go with overwhelming.
All right, all right,
I will take that criticism there and correct accordingly. It would be overwhelming, though. And so I think what he's saying is there's no question that this meets that test. It meets the threshold, and that Congress could, and that he would not disagree with that assessment. And the other thing, though, you know, is that I think what Amash is doing is trying to lay out a kind of way of thinking about politics that is not strictly partisan. And that is what is always the best thing about him, or one of the best things, I should say, is that a bunch of the kind of argument he makes in his tweet storm is that this has entirely been decided on partisan grounds rather than on the accumulation of the evidence and rather than on a kind of partisan blind. Right. Like there's nobody's looking at this and saying, well, I'm not going to look at the fact that Donald Trump is Republican or what my own party affiliation is. And
but in
and
that
Amash
sense,
is arguing against that.
In that sense, isn't what Mitt Romney clip at the top of the show said, like he actually is more accurately describing the world. Now, I understand the exercise of that Amash tweet storm was sort of narrow. Right. He was saying, I have scrutinized the legalisms of this question, and all I am saying is, legally speaking, here is my assessment, right? But of course, Romney is right to say, actually, that's a relatively small part of the case for impeachment. That's, in fact, almost an irrelevant part because of the way impeachment actually works and the general opinion of the American public and also the makeup of the Senate are by far more important. And so in that sense, it is a partisan issue.
Romney is right that it's a political issue, but it's almost entirely a political issue. I mean, you kind of can't impeach the president for like saying I don't like broccoli, but you can you can impeach the president.
Was that
for,
like a
like,
George H.W. Yeah. shout out
or,
right there?
Or like for spoiling
he
it, right? So Obama got Game of Thrones
noose.
Episodes way before anybody else. It's good to be the president. And like you couldn't impeach him for spoiling Game of Thrones, then maybe we should have.
I would absolutely be like,
right, but like
here's my tweet storm about impeaching the president about spoilers.
Because it is a political question, because there is no legal test, I think it's very clear that what's described in the report, which is the president very consistently attempted, most of the time he failed, but attempted to not uphold the law as is his constitutional duty. And there are multiple instances of the president attempting to defy his constitutional duty contained within the Mueller report. And that is impeachable.
Nick, you wrote about this over the weekend in a fine post, and part of what you were focusing on was the president's own reactions, some of which I'll quote here. Never a fan of Justin Amash, a total lightweight who opposes me and some of our great Republican ideas and policies just for the sake of getting his name out there through controversy. If he actually read the biased Mueller report, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, how do you obstruct when there is no crime? And in fact, the crimes were committed by the other side. Justin is a loser who sadly plays right into our, our opponents.
Can we talk about how much projection is in there, by the way? He's like, the only motivation I can fathom for what happened here is someone trying to get attention for themselves through notoriety
by tweeting.
Nick, what's your take on the president's characterizations there?
I think he's wrong, but it's completely characteristic of him to attack people for at the ad hominem level and for personal failings that, as Catherine was suggesting, reside more deeply in the breast of Donald J. Trump as opposed to anybody he's castigating. I don't agree with, or let me put it this way. I don't think the president should be impeached. I don't think he's going to be. But I really appreciate what Amash is doing. And it's not simply in this instance. It's, as Peter was saying, through his entire political career. I mean, this is a guy who spent most of his time battling Republicans for being really lousy on their own stated aspirations and ideals. And I'm much more interested in what this says about the possibility of Justin Amash running for president on the Libertarian Party ticket or starting to articulate a different position in politics that can actually start gaining adherence. We've talked a lot about the libertarians in Congress. And 10 years ago or more, we were basically talking about people like Rand Paul, Justin Amash, and Thomas Massey. We're still talking about them only because there really are not that many more. Something has to change. And I would love to see Amash go for a larger audience with a larger view that's not simply about policy, but what is the vision of his America, because I think it's one that I would largely agree with, and I think it's one that would actually change the conversation we're having about politics, which is really kind of awful.
Here's a possibly weird way to think about this, Catherine, is there's always a difference between someone who is an ideologue and someone who's a partisan. Both Amash and Rand Paul make, and Thomas Massey too, they all make this point that partisanship is not the good thing. Ideology is. You want people with more ideology on some level because they have a more philosophical basis of how they approach things, and it's kind of more honest in that process. Is there something like you want the ideologue to be a backbencher, don't you? Like more than an executive, an ideologue as an executive can be kind of more scary because that might be, Bernie Sanders, who we'll talk about soon. What do you think about my false choice there?
Definitely a false choice is what I think about it. This is obviously I am pro ideology over partisanship every time. I have long said that one of the worst things about the Trump administration is that he is not an ideologue. He has almost no discernible ideology at all, which makes it very hard to gauge what he will do next and also hard to do business with him or build coalitions. At the same time, I think that ideologues who are not authoritarian or absolutist would make perfectly good top of the ticket people, and that it's only when you get a full-fledged "I will burn you all in the spirit of the perfectibility of man" type ideology that things start to go a little wrong. And by a little wrong, I mean like mass starvation and death. And so I actually think,
like King's Landing,
there are ideologies that are better suited or worse suited to the top seat. I think in American politics recently, the ability of libertarian or market-friendly ideologues to position themselves correctly to be at the top of anybody's ticket has not happened. And I don't think that that's a permanent and forever thing, but it certainly is a notable pattern right now. And I think, you mentioned Rand Paul, and I'm going to keep going with my metaphor because it's a disease. He's Tyrion, right? He has tried to advise and compromise and see a way through.
He's really not that. He's not that short, Catherine.
He has funny curly hair.
Although he does have curly hair.
And, in the show, Tyrion lands on his feet. He manages at the last minute to snatch principle from the jaws of loyalty, but I do not know if that will happen in real life. And in the meantime, King's Landing is burning.
Has burned.
Let's, Matt, and I'd be curious as to your answer to your own question, but it's like, of course you want politicians who are ideological, meaning that they have some kind of at least general vision.
I mean, principled is another way to say it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's also more specifically, I want a president, or I want a government that is run on libertarian principles. We've tried everything else, including no principles, including pragmatism, including a kind of left-wing authoritarianism and a right-wing authoritarianism. It's like it's time to actually make the case for why libertarian ideas don't just make for better politics and better policies, but also a better world. And this, in a way, and I realize this is, pumping a lot of air into, a series of tweets. But I think Amash is somebody who can do that.
We're at a
point where the baby boom generation and Gen X, for whether it's good or ill, like, their time is done. And when you look at the constellation of new leaders and you see people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Pete Buttigieg and Justin Amash, it's striking. They're all young. They're all kind of multi-ethnic. They have or they have odd deviations to their personality that would have made it harder for them to succeed in politics or to be generational spokespeople even 10 or 15, 20 years ago. This is a clash of ideas. And I think, somebody like Amash is bringing a really strong argument, both from experience as well as from ideas. And I would love to see that, really go big.
I just want to add a little bit to that. Like, I in a lot of ways, I would have preferred Amash to get to sort of try to get attention for himself by tweeting about entitlements or about foreign policy, right? Or about, about like...
That's adorable.
Right.
I recognize
that that is not the political... And he does, I think, too. That is not the political environment we're in. And so, I think part of what you see in his statements is that if you want to be a libertarian, specifically libertarian, that is to say, not just a kind of conservative light or a Democrat who's maybe in favor of lower taxes, but really distinct from the two parties, and that's what libertarians are at their strongest, I think, then right now, you have to be, you have to position yourself directly in opposition to President Trump, who is not and has never been a libertarian. And it is, I think, unfortunate that you have to do that in some sense on kind of process and ethics grounds. That is not the political environment I would like to be in, but it is the one we're in. And nobody, and sort of related to that, nobody's like, oh, Justin Amash is just a Democrat, right? That's basically what he is. And so what he then has to do is define himself apart and from the Republican Party and from the Republican majority and from the leader of the Republican Party right now. And that is sort of the place that libertarians or people who want to raise the profile of libertarian politics are going to have to be.
I would just amend that to say that there's a difference between someone who is an elected official and one with very strong and kinky ambitions, as Justin Amash has, he's a politician who is thinking.
Something that we don't?
No, I don't. No, just that he's he's openly weighing whether he's going to run for president, and a certain type of personality does that, and a certain type does not. But that's one category of how to be a libertarian in the world. There's other categories about how to be a libertarian in the world, and those might very well be working in the Trump administration to try to further libertarian goals. And I think there are people who are at least are libertarian-ish who have tried to do that on some narrow grounds, and maybe they cash out after 6 months, bewildering. But there's more than one way to be a libertarian in the world, Peter Sweden.
I totally agree with that. And it may even be that the people working on the inside are more effective in making incremental policy change in the near term.
It's always going to be a mix. It's always going to be a mix of things.
What I said was that Amash was trying to draw attention to libertarianism and to libertarians and libertarian politics. And if you're trying to get that attention, then right now, getting attention in that way means defining yourself apart from Donald Trump and the Republican Party.
I also think the libertarian disposition at its best is against loyalty. Like, I think that our politics right now is too heavy on loyalty. It is too heavy on tribalism and team spirit. And that a thing that libertarians have long done is be in but not of the Republican Party for the most part. And that this move in particular by Amash, unlike other, again, totally viable, reasonable strategies to bring more libertarianism into American politics, this move by Amash is undergirded by what I think is just like an appropriately lower value on tribal loyalty than other people in Washington are currently displaying.
I think that the big thing that is missing from the libertarian kind of sensibility in politics is that it has not become a cultural movement, or it does not speak to people's aspirations outside of government. And that's something that Amash has not done yet. And when you listen to people like Buttigieg, when you listen to people like AOC, they're talking politics is the tool, or it's the instrument to implement a vision of the world, as opposed to it's just a set of policies. And I think this is if Amash is serious about kind of becoming more of a player in the way that we talk about things, he needs to flesh out exactly what is the larger kind of social, cultural dimension to libertarian ideas that he sees that he thinks should prevail in the country and then be implemented in policy. And that's something that none of the politicians, Rand Paul came close to it, but I think ultimately shied away and was much more comfortable talking about politics and policy. And that's part of the failure of Rand Paul. And Matt, you know, to you, you're my libertarian moment. Like we have not been able to kind of assert a large cultural vision that is transformational of American society. And that's where we need to go if we actually want to change the world.
The person who really wins the Game of Thrones is the one who can tell the best story.
Whoa.
That's right. Yeah. A couple of...
And also if you're in a wheelchair.
Right? Couple of cleanup notes before we do a heel turn is that Andy Craig, who I think now works for Cato, is a longtime... sort of activist within the Libertarian Party, got 10% of the vote in Wisconsin or some damn state running for Congress in, I think, 2016. But anyways, he tweeted out in response to this something along the lines of, gosh, I sure hope Justin Amash runs for president because we got no backup plan.
That is true.
Which is, you know, with due respect to the Adam Kokeshes of the world, that is true in the large thing. The other thing is just to remind people who are interested in that process for the Libertarian Party, they don't choose until May 2020. So there is no...
So stupid. So stupid.
It's complicated. It has to do with lots of dumb things.
It's not. It's complicated. It's still stupid.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, like, you're a third party and you're going to come up with your candidate after, you know, the other parties have chosen and have done a whole kind of... you know, beauty pageant for a year or a year and a half.
Yeah.
It's really stupid.
But it's just a way of saying that Amash doesn't have to be that guy now. At the same time, if you only start being that guy or decide to be that guy in April 2020, that's 1,000 years in Lannister time. And that's the last time I'm ever going to say any of those words. But at least
we never have to talk about Game of Thrones ever
again. Today's the last day. We're all done.
It's like when it's when L.A. Law went off the air. We stopped talking about it, Matt. Remember how obsessed we were with L.A.
Is
Law?
Is that like Harry Hamlin?
As a nation. Yeah, I think so. And Jimmy Smits and Susan Day, of course.
Wow. And, hashtag never forget. All right. Speaking of ideologues.
Yeah. Quality.
Murphy
team.
Brown.
Murphy ass yeah. Brown. No, Bernie Sanders.
Oh, I thought that was Saturday. I really thought this was going somewhere else.
Noted ideologue Murphy Bernie Sanders Brown on Saturday came out in favor of a national ban on for-profit charter schools. And to my surprise, at least the comparatively centrist, also Democratic candidate, Pete Buttigieg, said, yeah, that sounds all right. And also last week, of course, we'd be remiss not to mention that noted charter school hater, Bill de Blasio, officially made his stupid run for president official. So let's just start with the idea of banning
for-profit charter schools. Catherine, why is that a bad idea?
Such a bad idea. Couple reasons. First of all, for-profit charter schools are the tiniest little fragment of the schools in America. So if you are making that, as Bernie Sanders did, the second point in your 10-point education plan, your plan is about politics, not about actually reforming schools. It's just ridiculous. And, you know, I think that there is a similar problem at work with the discussion about for-profit prisons. But I think in this case, especially, the vast majority of charter schools are nonprofit. The vast majority of schools are still traditional public. And so to look at the tiny number of relatively successful schools that are charters that happen to be run by for-profit charter management firms and to say, like, right there, I figured it out. This is what's wrong with American schools is pure garbage. In particular, though, his first point is desegregate schools. And I want to point out, as many have before me, that if there is any entity in education right now that is doing a good job of desegregating schools in places that have been highly segregated because of zip code entitlements, it's charters. Charters cater largely to underserved populations. They do it in a way that generates schools that are more diverse, not less diverse. And to pretend otherwise is to just straight up lie about the facts on the ground, which Bernie Sanders seems willing to do. I am angry about this plan. Can you tell?
Wow.
It's really stunning. The attack on charter schools by Democrats, and it's all of them. You know, they will, some of them will at times say, oh, you know what, I'm kind of into, like Cory Booker, charter schools make good sense because they give poor people the choice that middle class and upper middle class and wealthy people take for granted. They all back away from it. And it's for one reason, which is because the teachers unions, who are major players in Democratic Party politics, are against charter schools because they take power away from teachers unions and put it in the hands of students and the parents of students. Every study, randomized control tests of the effects of charters, particularly in urban areas, which is what we're talking about here, shows that they will reduce the gap, the earnings gap, or the achievement gap between what's in New York is sometimes called the Scarsdale Harlem gap, by 2/3 in math and 50% in reading and things like that. These are actually really good ways of changing the educational morass in America. And the only reason why Democratic candidates and also many Republican candidates in places like Texas, where charter schools are not popular, it's because of, a slavish devotion to the past and to the power status quo. It's really awful. And these people should be called out, particularly as if they've called themselves progressive. Because the educational status quo is the most regressive part of American life for most people, because you spend 12 or 13 years in it. Taxpayers, that's like the biggest chunk of everybody's tax bill. And it's just horseshit.
Peter, to Nick's point, saying that Democrats are barking when the teachers union say how high. Did I get that right, Catherine? That wasn't necessarily the case 10 years ago or even like 7 years ago. I mean, Barack Obama appointed a moderately reformist Secretary of Education in Arne Duncan. The race to the top, which was that small beer, but still incentivized some amount of charter creation. But it seems like by 2016, when it was Hillary versus Bernie for the Democratic nomination, you knew everyone was going to be terrible on this. And it just sort of feels like the center of gravity has gone much more vociferously against school choice, charter schools, and et cetera. To what, if anything, do you attribute this to? Like, why did it get soft there for a while and then it went back hard?
I think it got soft there for a little while just because Barack Obama was actually I won't say great instincts when it came to education, but was someone who was personally ideologically even invested in the idea of school reform. And so that was part of the Barack Obama brand. And the Democratic Party kind of reoriented itself around that brand. That is just not part of the Kamala Harris, Bernie Sanders political brand at all. And that is not what the Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party stands for in any way. They are an outlet and a voice for teachers unions. And they put teachers unions first, above and before nearly any other constituency, certainly above and before students themselves.
I do want to say, though, you don't need to do the follow the money analysis here. Like, I think it's good to do it because I think it is underdone in general in mainstream coverage of this issue. At the same time, the vast majority of people who think they hate charter schools, who say they hate charter schools and think the charter schools are a source of inequality and evil, they are not in the pay of teachers unions, right? They are just normal people who think that they understand what's going on out there, which is like someone somewhere is making money and that's bad.
They have kind of a generalized anti-profit instinct.
Have a general anti-profit instinct. And so I think it's actually important to combat this largely on that level, which is to say,
as Bernie Sanders has a generalized
anti-profit instinct. You know, and so I think it's important to just sort of, you know, in addition to talking about this in the follow the money
that presumes...
way, it's also, I just, you know, I think when people change their minds on this issue, they do it because they see that charter schools are helping people that the public schools have abandoned. And I think just talking about that every time and always is the most important thing.
I think in a political context, it's always worth talking about the power structure of the Democratic establishment. Hillary Clinton, in It Takes a Village and in the late 90s, was pro-charter school. The reason, Matt, why people in the Democratic Party are now really against charter schools is because they're growing by leaps and bounds. And even though, right, you know, fewer than about 10% of K through 12 kids go to any kind of school of choice, most go to conventional residential assignment schools that have been around for, you know, 100 years. They're growing and they recognize that threat. And I also think I agree with you, Catherine, that it's always worth looking at the efficacy of the programs. But we also need to talk about somehow teachers unions or the status quo. Like nobody makes money being a school teacher. Nobody makes money running a school or selling curricula to, you know, massive school districts. Like the fact is that education is a multi-billion-dollar industry in America, and everybody has their hand out. So it's worth kind of underscoring that there are real financial interests at work here in the status quo, and kind of revealing that. I think is always kind
and
of
just
helpful.
To Catherine's point earlier about this, about the kind of scale of charter schools, and in terms of the federal budget, the federal education budget is something like $70 billion, a little less. Charter schools get about $440 million. That's $440 million.
Though the federal budget isn't the main.
But in terms of thinking about the scale of federal education,
and in terms of thinking about what
versus Bernie, how much the federal government spends, that's the kind of numbers.
But it is important. You also learn about like what is a president, you know, because a president is not just running on policies, it's a vision. And like, what kind of vision of the world are you in where you are going to take the educational status quo, which, you know, at best has shown no improvement in student performance over the past 40 years, despite a doubling or a tripling of per student spending, you know, at all levels. And most of that is at the state and local level. And you're going to say, yeah, you know what we need to do? We need to make sure this stays around even longer and pump more money into it. That's an insane backward looking way to be thinking about education. Charter schools are extremely popular among Democratic voters. Hispanics, it's like 50%. Of Hispanic Democrats like charter schools, 55% or so of Blacks like them, only 25% of white Democrats. And it's because there is a huge class component to education, and that is the residential assignment. And like, you know, we need to do a class analysis of the educational status quo. I moved to California in 1993 when Republicans backed a statewide ballot initiative there, which would have done a pure kind of Milton Friedman universal voucher program. And it turned out, you know, it got crushed by like, you know, 70 to 30 or something like that. And the only people who voted for it were inner city minorities and libertarians, which didn't add up to a lot of people in California. But there is a class thing going on here. And, you know, if you live in a suburb, if you live in a school district, you are keeping people out of your schools, out of class interests as much.
Bernie Sanders' vision of the world is of one size government run solutions for nearly everything, one size fits all government run solutions for nearly everything, in which nearly everyone, as many people as possible are employed directly by the state, and that's what this is about.
Catherine, at the risk of doing to you what it would be like if you asked me a question about Game of Thrones.
Uh-oh.
I want you to react to this sports ball tweet by Bernie Sanders. I like that noise, which is this. If we look If we are a nation that can pay baseball players hundreds of millions of dollars, don't tell me we can't afford to pay teachers the salaries they deserve. What's wrong with that sentence, Catherine?
So many things. And like, thank you for giving me a softball, as they say in the sports metaphors.
Oh, very good.
I can handle this one, I think. So first of all, there's just a math problem here, which is that there are not that many baseball players and there are lots and lots and lots of teachers. And so the idea that you could somehow take this bucket of money and distribute it to these other more worthy people, which is, by the way, the basis of basically everything Bernie Sanders and indeed much of the Democratic field is up to, it is not going to work, right? This idea that there is somehow enough like super, super rich people who don't deserve it based on some kind of calculus, which varies between the candidates, that we can just take that money and solve all the problems. We've talked about this before on this podcast. That never works. But, of course, he is also making a deeper point about, you know, the fact that markets don't recognize virtue or sort of intrinsic worth. That is true. That's not the thing markets do. The thing markets do is not sort people by their moral value and then assign them a dollar figure. That's 100% not what markets do. What they do is they are a tool to help people allocate scarce labor and resources to their most efficient ends using prices to convey information. One piece of information that the teacher salaries convey is there are lots of people who can perform that function, some better than others, no doubt. There are many, many teachers who are truly excellent and do deserve to earn money at a baseball player level. They would be able to do that if the market for teaching were, in fact, something closer to a free market instead of a tightly controlled cartel.
It's worth noting that teachers' unions have, in some cases, opposed contracts that allow for performance bonus for some teachers to get much more, say, to make well into six figures, provided that they meet certain tests in terms of how they actually perform.
In D.C., Michelle Rhee was basically brought down by her attempt to give everyone a raise, but to give superstar teachers more of a raise. That was considered an absolutely unacceptable offer.
Yeah.
The other thing to think about is that teachers' unions, you know, teachers overwhelmingly are represented by teachers' unions that have done an incredibly poor job in actually raising the cash in the pocket of teachers. They negotiate consistently bigger compensation packages, much of which is predicated upon retirement benefits, which are on paper but are not actually being collected. And teachers are getting screwed by their unions because they're not getting more money right now, and they're going to retire into a system that is bankrupt where they're going to be taking a haircut. But that's the union's fault, and teachers should hold their union representatives accountable. But, you know, that's where teachers should be looking for better representation.
I've also seen teachers' unions, even just in my kids' schools, play a crucial role in keeping excellent teachers who don't have exactly the right credentials on paper out of the classroom. There have been, just in my very short time as a public school parent, there have been several assistant teachers who have come and gone out of my children's lives who would have been more than qualified to stay on and teach, but they didn't have exactly the right little black scribbles on exactly the right piece of paper. And those requirements are not a product of something about, certainly nothing at the specific school level where everyone recognized the value of these people who were contributing, but instead negotiated large scale deals between the teachers' unions and the district.
It's protectionism and it's anti-student. Charter schools are an effort to make public school suck just a little bit less. And Bernie Sanders, of course, hates that.
I want to congratulate myself here for being a good moderator in that I am not going to spend the next 20 minutes haranguing everyone Lenny Bruce late career style about the awful public school.
Jesus, Matt, tell us you're not on the toilet right now.
Totally on the toilet right now.
Really about, late career.
about my Lenny public Bruce. School experience here in the great city of New York.
I would be okay with you spending
write,
the next 20
worth,
minutes.
No, it's
you
worth
should write
it.
An article about
it's
that for Reason Magazine. How about that, Matt?
I've got a pretty good top 1,500 words, Catherine.
Good idea. Let's hear about it in print.
In written form. I want to shift gears here to make sure we have enough time for it to talk about an actual federal policy as opposed to a mostly local policy that people seem to, who, by the way, Catherine, you're the keeper of all the dumb Democratic ideas here. Who's the one that's like, let's give every teacher like a 15% raise, or is it a $15,000 raise? Was that Kamala? Who did that one?
Well, that's actually in, that's sort of in the Bernie plan. Everybody's getting a raise, but Kamala Harris absolutely does have a, just a flat teacher like credit in her package as well.
Thanks, Kamala. Anyway, so President Trump last week announced a long gestated, long awaited immigration plan or set of guidelines cobbled together by his son-in-law and senior advisor Jared Kushner, having to do with immigration. The plan was not at all devised by lawmakers. It's not tied to any piece of legislation. It would boost skills-based immigration from 12% to 57%, while decreasing family-based and lottery-based immigration by 50%. It also wouldn't touch a whole bunch of hot-button issues in immigration, including what to do about this sort of stranded DACA kids, the Deferred Action Against Childhood Arrivals, whatever that's called, program and such like. Kind of curious. It made headlines for about an hour and a half, and people seem to have mostly forgotten about it. Suderman, can you just sort of start with the you live in D.C., the kind of the process DOA-ness of this weird thing?
I mean, it's not going to go anywhere, in part because it doesn't deal at all with the Dreamers, which is a big focus for Democrats, and in part because it's not nearly hardline enough for Republican immigration hawks like Stephen Miller, even in Trump's administration, but certainly for the kind of outside groups. And related to this, there is some antipathy between Republicans on Capitol Hill and Jared Kushner. And there's been reporting about this, and it's just the kind of thing you hear, is that Kushner really thinks he's so confident about his ability to do nearly anything. And he does not understand. I think there was a quote to this effect. He didn't understand that in this deal, his job wasn't to design the deal and put together the Kushner plan. His job was to be there to ensure that somebody communicated the basics to President Trump and ensured that President Trump was actually on board with what was supposed to be President Trump's plan, because Trump obviously is not highly involved in the details or negotiations of the policy here. And so because of all of this, because it is a DOA not going anywhere plan, there's just not a huge amount of interest in it.
I want to read you just a passage from the New York Times coverage of the release of the plan. Senator Kevin Cramer, Republican of North Dakota and a close Trump ally, says lots of encouragement in the room here among the Republicans. And then the next paragraph begins. But Mr. Cramer laughed when he was asked how Republicans would get Democrats on board with the plan. And I think that's about right. Like, just a wee little giggle fit at the very idea that any of this would actually amount to a workable compromise. I also saw that Chuck Schumer is legit just like hitting forward on Gang of Eight emails from back in the day, like to people to just be like, remember this? How about this? At the same time, grateful for small mercies, this plan does not actually reduce overall immigration. That's something.
It's good to see that the Trump administration is not going near, you know, full immigration hawk, and has in its public release of a plan not been completely overtaken by the worst, most retrograde aspects of the Republican Party when it comes to immigration. On the other hand, in some ways, it doesn't matter that much since the plan just isn't happening.
Nick, let's talk about the animating idea here, which is let's swap out family visas and the visa lottery system, which, to be clear, since Donald Trump gets this wrong on purpose every time because he lies and he's bad, the visa lottery system isn't you put a bunch of jihadis in a room and they wait for the Powerball number to show up. It's a system by which countries that don't traditionally send America a lot of immigrants the potential candidates have to pass a bunch of different thresholds to then enter a system. And then after that those countries send a small number of immigrants there. But anyways, it's basically swapping out family based and a lottery-based immigration for high-skills immigration, going more towards the Canada system. What is wrong with that idea, if anything, Nick Gillespie?
Nothing is necessarily wrong with it unless it means that certain people can't get in. I mean, I think what we need is more immigration, not less immigration. And, you know, it is true that like family-based immigration, you know, it's understandable from a humanitarian point of view, but it also means that if you are a Mexican and you don't have family here, you're kind of screwed. And that's bad. And also high-skilled immigration is a similar thing. I think, you know, a much better approach is to figure out How do you allow more people to come here and live and work legally, period? And that's the better thing. In the Trump proposal, the idea of reducing who can come on a family kind of situation to, you know, immediate nuclear family is not a bad idea. I think there's, you know, there's some value to that. I think H-1Bs are overrated, and that, you know, employers and workers shouldn't be held to such standards, that there are better ways to let more people, to process more people, and bring in more people are going to be a net benefit to the country. The whole problem with immigration, particularly when you start looking at it from a kind of like skills-based thing, is it's based on this fiction that the federal government of all people knows how to manage what, you know, what the workforce should look like in America this year and next year and a couple of years down the road. That's a kind of lunatic fantasy of having knowledge that is really bad. And I think it's much better to let immigrants and employers and people, you know, wherever they are, figure out like who wants to come here and who wants to work here.
Catherine, over the weekend or even this morning, the president made some comments, at least saying, you know, E-Verify, that system, it's pretty hard on employers. Do you want to give the kids a quick libertarian lesson into why the president might be right that E-Verify isn't the awesome thing?
E-Verify isn't the awesome thing. He is right about that. Of course, it's sort of very typically Trump that he would be like, hey, you know, people who do, like, who hire large amounts of people find the system cumbersome as his, like, core critique, because it's a totally fair critique. It is a horribly designed, cumbersome system. It makes the, like, Obamacare launch look smooth. It's really quite bad. However, the real complaint against E-Verify is that, I guess, a couple. First, there's a fundamental violation of civil liberties. You should not have to have your name checked against a government list to be allowed to work, which is what this amounts to. It means that every single person who wants to get a job anywhere, ever and always, somebody has to go check their name in a government database to see if that's even allowed. That is not a precedent that I want to set. It's not, this is already, to some extent, how we deal with the Social Security numbers, and that is a big mess that I think everyone can agree we don't want to like double down on. Also, those lists, the underlying lists, are terrible. They are so terrible that states that have attempted to use them to implement an E-Verify or E-Verify-like system have wound up abandoning the effort. There have been states that have said, like, yes, we have a lot of illegal immigrants. Our employers want us to help them hire people who are legal. They implement the database, employers search people's names against the database, and then they hire people who are cleared by the database, and then they get in trouble with the federal government for having hired a bunch of illegal immigrants. This is not a hypothetical. This is a story that happened over and over in Arizona and other places. We should not duplicate it nationwide. Donald Trump is correct.
Very good. Let's, since I predict there's going to be some discussion about the thing, let's shift to our end of show. What have you been consuming in the cultural arena? Suderman, go ahead.
I saw John Wick 3, and it was great. It's really the fun thing about one of the many, many, many fun things about those movies. It is probably the greatest action franchise, pure action franchise, in Hollywood right now. And part of what makes it so much fun to watch is that there's an actual understanding of how firearms work. And there is just a huge amount of like, here is, now there's also kind of, there's also a lot of fantasy about how firearms work. But for example, in
Peter,
the new
by
one,
the way, just amended that because I was making yes. the most skeptical face you could possibly imagine.
But in the whole third act of the second one is built around is a little too strong. Heavily involves a repeated use of the, like a reminder that guns are heavy. And this is a thing that you just don't see in like movies about, you know, with shoot 'em ups a lot, which is that like guns are heavy, they have weight. And so Wick is sort of plowing through waves and waves of dudes. And every time he runs out of bullets, he like, you sort of, you get this moment of like, oh crap, what am I going to do? And he will look at his gun and realize I have a heavy object in my hand, and he will throw the gun at their faces, right? And so it's right, and so it becomes this sort of like dance move in which that is incorporated into the reload timing. There is a delightful gag in the new one in which just as the bad guys are starting to chase him relatively near the beginning of the movie, he stumbles into, of course, a room that has a wall full of ammunition, and then a case full of ancient pistols. So he pulls one of the bullets off of the wall and tries to load it into one of these ancient pistols, and it doesn't fit. And he looks around and he's like, oh man, what am I going to do? These guys are coming. They're coming right, like they're around the corner. And so as they're coming around the corner, he rebuilds a custom firearm out of all of the different component parts that he can load exactly one bullet into exactly the right amount of time to take out the first guy who comes around the corner, and then dive into a hallway full of knives, which produces absolutely the best sequence. Like I said, it's
these
very realistic.
These movies sound so stupid.
It's very realistic. No, they're so delightful.
They're fun.
And they're so clever, and they get what's interesting about action sequences, which is the movement of the human body. And there just aren't a lot of great action movies out there. Even like the big action movies that we have, are the action is often kind of weak. I think in the Marvel movies in particular, I really like a lot of them in a lot of ways, but the action sequences as kind of pure action sequences, they work best as little character beats rather than as actual action beats. And John Wick gets it, and there just aren't that many American action films that do, and so it's super fun.
I would just add that Keanu Reeves remains, the most underappreciated, although he's starting to get appreciated, actors of our generation. People just don't watch.
He was so great in River's Edge, and he's living. He's fantastic. He's a really good presence.
He's been only, very good for a very long time, when we sort of forget that, right? He's been with us now for like 30 years. We've been watching Keanu Reeves kind of blankly woe his way across Hollywood.
And but that one about the wine in the Marin Valley, whew, that's a stinker. Nick,
he's got a lot of stinkers.
What stinkers have you been consuming?
I started rereading Nathaniel West's Miss Lonely Hearts, which is about a newspaper writer who is a man who writes a Miss Lonely Hearts column. And it is one of the, I had forgotten what a truly dark book it is. It is an absolute, like, it's pitch black in there. I mean, you got to bring a flashlight to read it. It is so fucking dark, to a point where I actually stopped before finishing it again, because it's just, it's a little bit too much.
Nathaniel West
but it's
is
a fantastic,
so great.
And he published four novels before he died on his honeymoon. He was yet again a bad driver. He's like the Roy Campanella of mid-level American authors. He has three of the four novels, Miss Lonely Hearts, Day of the Locust, and Cool Million, which also doesn't get talked about much, but is a great satire of 1930s America, and the way in which it's kind of a version of Candide, where everybody from union leaders to tycoons to politicians literally whittle away the body of the main character. Really, he's worth checking into every once in a while, because if you ever want to make yourself feel good about not being completely dark, read Nathaniel West, because you'll look like an albino in comparison.
Catherine?
I watched the trailer for Westworld. That's what I watched this
over and
weekend,
over again.
Over and over.
Yeah.
It's robots walking among us. It's obviously of keen interest to me. I'm excited that the new one looks like it's set in something more neon lit and futury. Not that I don't like me some dusty cowboy hat robots, but I think that the new setting will refresh the show and be awesome. Also spent the weekend rereading Good Omens. I've talked about it before. I will talk about it again. I am extremely excited about the Good Omens series, which is launching in, I think, 10 days. Terry Pratchett, Neil Gaiman, a demon, an angel, co-written. It's hilarious. Hopefully it will be good.
It was apparently Terry Pratchett's dying wish that Neil Gaiman bring this to the screen. And Gaiman's like, I'm doing this for my buddy. I could be making a lot more money writing novels, which tells you how much money Neil Gaiman makes writing novels.
A lot.
But he's like, this is what he wanted. This is like the last thing he emailed me before he died. And
to be clear, they co-wrote it and they wrote, like, Terry Pratchett wrote the angel and Neil Gaiman wrote the demon, who is described in the book as an angel who didn't so much fall as saunter vaguely downward. And there's a whole, you know, through thousands of years of human history, they are wacky buddies and opposites. Like, the buddy comedy in which Terry Pratchett is an angel and Neil Gaiman is a demon. Like, if that doesn't appeal to you, I don't want to be your friend.
So I watched, obviously I'm doing a lot of basketball playoffs over the weekend on, and this was on TNT yesterday. It was double overtime. Great game. It was great. And they had these, and I was working or noodling on my.
Who are you rooting for, Matt?
I'm rooting for the Blazers, so that's not really good. Mm-hmm. But I'm just rooting for a fun competition in the Eastern Conference. And I like the Bucks uniforms. That green is very winning to me. So ultimately, I kind of want them to win. So I kind of just sort of let the game end, and the next show that came on was something I'd absolutely never heard of, although I see it referenced in commercials, called Animal Kingdom, which is a terrible name for what is essentially kind of a mashup between maybe Breaking Bad and John from Cincinnati, except not as good as either by leaps and bounds. But it's a family of ne'er-do-wells run by a kind of controlling, demented and sexualized criminal leader, Ellen Barkin, who plays somebody named Smurf, and it's her family. And it's just like, I love the fact that there can be shows you've absolutely never heard of on networks that you don't associate with television, except for maybe, you know, Charles Barkley halftime gigs, making pretty good, like, B-minus to solid gentlemen's B material out there about criminal families. And, like, where Dennis Leary is a bit actor on the side, playing an opioid junkie in the desert. Why not? It's just kind of great out there. And if I actually watched television, I would be happy to know that there's a lot of good television out there.
It's based on a 2010 Australian film that was pretty well regarded.
And Ellen Barkin is phenomenal. Like, she's really, really good and, like, legit kind of terrifying without being over the top. And that's it. So thank you all for listening and participating in our weekly editors roundtable. Please leave comments where there's places to do that, and listen to our back material too. Nick's been doing some phenomenal interviews. Dan Okrent last week was great, and other things like that. And until next Monday, goodbye. Thank you.